Well, this text, some of you got to go through it in depth at midweek, which is great, and you'll be able to benefit from that. But we're going to go in a little bit different direction this morning. In the 2nd century AD, the church leader Marcion began arguing that Christians should ditch the Old Testament completely and center the Christian faith entirely on the New Testament. His main argument was that the Old Testament God was a God of wrath and anger, and that the New Testament God was one of love and mercy. And so for Marcion, the two could not exist together. So the only solution for him was to get rid of the Old Testament. So was Marcion onto something? Should we even bother with the Old Testament? After all, it is the Old Testament, right? And much of it is uncomfortable. Some of it's hard to understand. Well, I mean, why can't we just have a smaller Bible? It'd be easier to carry around, and then maybe more people would bring it to church, and that would be awesome. Well, God and the New Testament just simply don't allow for that option. And the truth is, if you read your Bible, you realize the Old Testament talks about God's love way more than it gets credit for, and the New Testament actually talks about God's wrath way more than most realize. So it's an oversimplification to talk about them in those terms like Marcion did. So you may be wondering, well, what happened to this guy Marcion then? Well, he was excommunicated from the church in 144 AD, but his heretical teaching really still lives on in many ways that, you know, most Christians wouldn't verbally admit it, of course, but in practice, often we marginalize the Old Testament and some of its descriptions of God and sort of leave it behind with some of the uncomfortable or more difficult passage and perhaps just think it's a little bit outdated and it's all kind of corrected by the New Testament. And no doubt for Marcion and for some Christians, it's passages like Hosea 13 that cause them to feel the way they do. I mean, what do we do with a God who says, "So I will be like a lion to them, like a leopard, I will lurk by the path. Like a bear robbed of her cubs, I will attack them and rip them open. Like a lion, I will devour them. A wild animal will tear them apart." As the excommunication and heretical status given to Marcion over the last 2 millennia tells us, to be an Orthodox Christian, meaning to think rightly or correctly about the faith, is to recognize the Old Testament as Scripture, the Word of God. So ignoring it is not an option. So what do we do? The main problem for most people like Marcion are the wrathful passages in the Old Testament, such as Hosea 13, and their tension with a supposedly loving God. And we've seen this tension throughout Hosea as it is front and center, perhaps more than any other Old Testament book. And chapter 13 here is no exception. And so before we leave Hosea for good in a few weeks, I want to kind of take this morning in more of a pastoral moment, kind of putting aside our verse-by-verse preaching for a week to explore and hopefully resolve a bit the tensions between God's love and his wrath so that we might more accurately understand and know the God we worship. And my goal is that understanding God's wrath and justice will actually increase your love for him and your trust in him. For as we will see, a wrathless God is actually not a God worth worshiping. I've titled this morning the ABCs of God's wrath, referring to kind of the key words in the definition, which is really more like an outline that's on the back of your bulletin there, and that will help you kind of see what I'm doing here, and because they kind of go in order of A, B, C, D, E in its key words. And I sort of labored over this definition all week, so I hope that it makes sense and kind of helps this concept be clear to you. So here's how I'm going to define this morning the wrath of God and kind of use it as an outline to talk about. And this is on your bulletin to fill out here, that the wrath of God is an action, not emotion, on behalf of, not upon, the innocent. So A, action, B, behalf. Carried out and completed at the cross. You got 3 C's there. So that God could delight in mercy, not wrath. And we could hope in the end, that is to come. So I'm going to unpack this line by line and sort of break it down in alphabetical order, so to speak, line by line. So first, the wrath of God is an action, not an emotion. In her very important recent work entitled The Crucifixion, which was voted the 2016 Book of the Year by Christianity Today, and I'll be using it a little bit throughout this morning, Fleming Rutledge says that the wrath of God is not an emotion, it's God's righteous activity in setting right what is wrong. Some people view the God of the Old Testament as a God whose emotional instability sort of tosses him, you know, back and forth between feelings of anger and love, like, I love you, Israel. No, I hate you, Israel. He's impulsive and irrational and maybe almost schizophrenic in their mind, loving Israel one moment, cursing them out the next, losing control of his emotions. So is there a dichotomy in the personality of God? Well, to be sure, the faithful love of God and his frequent responses of anger towards Israel, they both have substantial biblical evidence. They're both there. So you can't miss them if you read the Bible. And the dilemma is, well, how can they coincide? What I want to show you is that a study of the Old Testament ideas of both God's divine love and God's divine anger work together, God's wrath, work together to communicate his desire to be in loving covenant relationship with his people. God's love, of course, is considered by many to be the main concept or central idea of the Old Testament. The Old Testament uses two main words to describe God's love in the Old Testament. The first is ahava, which means to love, and chesed, which means to love, but they have sort of different understandings. Ahava is sort of the election love of God, meaning God's unconditional love apart from the covenant, that he just loves them because he loves them. But that love leads to his other kind of love, his chesed, which you've heard many times here. If you've been here, it's the most important word probably in the Old Testament, his covenant love. Thus, kind of his ahava, his unconditional love, is what causes God to make a covenant and to act out his chesed, his loyal, faithful, persistent, determined, steadfast love, what we've called in this series a love that can't let go. And love is really the only motivation for God choosing Israel and extending his covenant to them. It's what caused God to bring Israel up out of Egypt, and there's really no explanation for God choosing Israel in the Old Testament except for his divine love. And God takes all the initiative in this act of love. So if God loves Israel and people in this way, well, what's with all the anger and wrath toward them, like that which we see in Hosea? Is it just a hopeless paradox that we can't solve? I think hardly. The only way to have a truly loving, passionate God is to also have a God who is therefore actually affected by the actions of people and takes action because of it. See, to have this idea of a loving God who would be one who just loves and loves and loves, completely removed from and indifferent to what people do and how they live, ironically, would actually lead to a God who would become incapable of an intense, devoted, involved love. Because if you have a God that removed who will just love you and not care at all what you do, that's not actually love. He becomes completely removed from your life and from your actions. And so you have to ask, is that really the God you want? And for some, I know, of course, the answer might be that that is the God that they want. But then, unfortunately, that's not the God of the Bible. And so you have to fashion your own God in your own image. Some might say, well, I just want God to leave me alone, let me do what I want, and just love me no matter what. But how could he love you and then at the same time not care and let you do whatever you want? You see the impossibility of those two things coexisting. You can't have it both ways. Of course, parenting is a decent, albeit imperfect, analogy here, and I really try very, very hard not to use illustrations from my kids' life. That's kind of like preaching 101. You're not supposed to do that, but once a year I can do it here. But it is such a good analogy, and this week Hannah was gone most of the week, and so I had lots of time with the kids, and we were playing outside on the street, and they were riding their little cars. And we were leaving, some of you will be there tonight, but so we live at the end of a cul-de-sac, and we were leaving the cul-de-sac heading toward the more busier Arbutus Road. And of course, Anya's out in front because she's able to go faster, and Amos is kind of behind me, and I'm sort of in the middle. Well, Amos had a little fall behind me, and so he begins to cry, and he's sad because he's fallen off his little car. Well, Anya continues moving forward towards the busier Arbutus Road, towards the stop sign. So I say, Anya, you know, hold on. Amos fell. I got to go back and get him. Just wait there. Well, Anya keeps going. You know, Anya, please stop there while we get Amos. You know, come back. Anya keeps going. So eventually, what do I have to do? Well, I'm getting a little bit angry that she's not listening to me because I'm seeing her move closer and closer to the traffic, and I'm too far to probably catch up with her if she keeps going. So in an angry voice to get her attention, I have to say, I won't say it too loud so she doesn't hear me, Anya, right? Because I had to get her attention. Like, she had to know I was really serious, and I'm upset that you're not listening to me. And then I had to somewhat, you know, angrily go toward her and pick her up and bring her back so that she would be okay and in safety. So was I angry at Anya because she was disobeying me and kept going? Yes. Was my anger justified? I think so. Her life was potentially at stake. So my anger was out of love and care for her well-being. If I had decided to punish her so that she wouldn't do it again, would that have been justified? Probably. After all, I would only be punishing her because I need her to know how serious her actions were, that this was potentially life and death, that she was heading toward danger and harm. Would it be loving for me to say, I just love Anya so much. No matter what she does, I could never get angry with her. I mean, I just want her to be happy. And if that means she just wants to keep riding her car out into the roads, I just want her to be happy. Right? I'll just let her go and I'll stand here loving away, thinking all lovely thoughts about her, letting her know how much I love her as she moves toward destruction. Is that love? No. So no, my disposition of love toward her led to action. And in this case, angry action, which was, I think, justified in the situation. My primary disposition toward Anya is one of love. I don't wake up with anger toward her as my main emotion, right? My anger is a secondary action based on my love, care, and concern for her. All human examples and analogies, of course, break down at some point, but hopefully that's sort of a helpful illustration. See that as God sees us heading down a road that is potentially harmful or destructive, and we're not heeding his voice, his word, and we keep going, well, he will eventually be angered. But is it just an emotional, whimsical anger because God isn't getting his own way? No. He's trying to keep us from harm. And our disobedience, even if we can't see it, maybe the way Anya couldn't see the destruction that was awaiting her, she just thinks, I would just want to keep going, I'm having fun. Even if we can't see it, God does what he needs to do to get our attention. So his anger flows out of love. So if you want a God who's actually involved in your life and in the world, he has to also be a God of justice, sometimes anger, who takes action when something is not right or potentially harmful. Otherwise, he is not truly a God of love. The God of the Bible is a God who is affected by actions of people. I mean, words dealing with anger are used over 500 times in over 380 contexts. in the Old Testament. I mean, this is a God who cares and is involved with what's going on. And the main cause of God's anger is Israel breaking the covenant relationship, which leads to all kinds of problems in society, in relationships, in their worship of God. All the things God intends for them become impossible when Israel does not follow the covenant. It all breaks down. And so his motivation is love and the good he has in store for them. In Hosea, God is angry because Israel, as we've seen, is destroying itself, and it breaks God's heart. The reality is you need both love and wrath. The idea of a wrathful God without the underlying motivation of love behind his anger would depict God, of course, as harsh and irrational. I mean, if I was angry at Anya for no reason at all, that would be wrong, right? That would be sinning in anger. But a God of intense love and holiness without the idea of wrath reduces God to an uninterested and indifferent God who is not concerned with the actions of his people and therefore not truly loving. God's wrath should be seen as an aspect of his love, as a consequence or action of his love. In fact, God's anger signifies his emphatically personal character and involvement in our lives. So the conclusion can be made that wrath is not a divine attribute, meaning it's not a permanent part of God's being or character, because it is always provoked. It doesn't just exist on its own. God does not forget his love for his people in just unwarranted fits of rage, where he's like, oh, I forgot, I'm supposed to love you. You know, I just like being angry at you. We don't get that kind of God in the Old Testament. It's actually humans and not God that are fundamentally responsible for wrath and its effects. Best way to think of this is the quote I have on your outline here by D.A. Carson, a respected theologian, and he says this, that where there is no sin, there is no wrath. But there will always be love in God. See, where there is no sin, there is no wrath. It's not God's idea. He doesn't want it. But there will always be love in God. So whereas the love of God is a permanent, unchanging emotion due to his ahava and his chesed, the chosen disposition of God toward his people, love, his wrath is a secondary action that only exists when it has to. It's not a permanent part of his being. So a little bit more on this in point number 4 later. But so the wrath of God is an action, not a permanent emotion. And it's an action on behalf of and not upon the innocent. So be behalf of, not upon the innocent. Even maybe more convincing than point number 1 is that because of God's love and concern for people, he must show displeasure at anything that violates his plans and purposes for the world. In the Old Testament, as we've seen in Hosea, it is primarily God's concern for justice for all, especially the poor and the powerless, the lost, the least, the left behind. His concern for them is what drives his anger. Can I kind of give you or give us a bit of a tough critique here on this issue? It's mostly people in affluent countries like ours in Canada, people with quote-unquote good lives, that have a hard time with this idea of God's wrath and justice. See, people in oppressed situations and nations who experience injustice on such a regular basis have less problem with a God who is angered by injustice and unrighteousness and wrathful because of it. And throughout history, it has not bothered most people as much as modern people in our comfortable lives, where often sickness and plagues and war and famine and all these things have less impact on our daily lives. See, just because we get angry about some stupid or superficial things that are usually selfish in nature, right? It's like, my latte wasn't made quite right, I'm angry. You know, I'm sitting in traffic, I'm angry. That person in front of me is asking for a price check while I wait in line behind them, I'm angry. Because our anger is often selfish, personal in nature, reflecting back on our own selves, we're usually angry for our own sake. Therefore, we have a hard time comprehending God's anger, because our anger is so far from a righteous and justified anger. I mean, quite honestly, it's fairly arrogant to say, or for us to think to say, how can I serve a God who is so wrathful? Because it kind of puts us out of touch with what's going on in most of the world and the need for justice. God's anger is almost always on behalf of those who have no privilege and have been wronged. Rutledge, to quote her again, says, "The wrath of God is not an emotion that flares up from time to time as though God has temper tantrums. It is a way of describing his absolute enmity or hatred against all wrong and his coming to set matters right." God displays his judgment and has his prophets such as Hosea preach judgment, not because it's what he wants to talk about, but it's because people are being wronged and something has to change. Right, so, I mean, I think of the reformer Martin Luther, who, you know, his congregation asked him, "Hey, when are you going to stop preaching the basic gospel message to us over and over again? Like, that's all you ever preach is the gospel." And he says, "As soon as I see some evidence that you get it, I'll stop preaching it." Right? And so maybe Israel or maybe us, we read the Old Testament and think, "Oh, God, when are you going to stop preaching judgment? When are you going to stop preaching wrath?" We might feel that way throughout Hosea as we've gone through it. Well, I think God's response would be, "As soon as you get it, I'll stop," right? But God continues to love his people and want what's best with them, so he continues to give that message. The conclusion can be made that wrath is not a divine attribute, meaning not a permanent part of God's character. How can you love a God who fails to punish wrong and evil? I mean, failure to hate evil would imply a deficiency in love. Yes, God's anger often brings punishment, but the punishment is not based on rage, but on a just retribution. I mean, sin is terrible. Sin hurts people. Sin hurts creation and the environment. Sin breaks down families and societies. I mean, God hates sin and therefore is justifiably angered by actions that lead to hurts and the breakdown of families and society and churches and on and on. As Miroslav Volf, the theologian, says, he says, "A non-indignant God would be an accomplice in injustice, deception, and violence." Is that a God that you want? Be careful what you wish for when you say, "I can't believe in a wrathful God." Idolatry, of course, is creating God in your own image. So if you want a God who is only loving and shows no anger, who turns a blind eye to injustice, to those who suffer at the expense of the powerful and the greedy, is that really the God you want? God's anger towards Israel, yes, includes them turning to other gods because that's harmful to them, but along with that, it's their failure to do justice, their social offenses, and there are so many scriptures on this, many that we've seen in Hosea, but you think of Isaiah chapter 10, verses 1 and 2 kind of sums it up. "Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless." God has a right to be angry, and to remove wrath from our idea of God is to forget about those who suffer from injustice and God's promise to set right all wrongs. So I've been mostly focused about kind of resolving this tension between God's love and wrath in the Old Testament because that's where we are, and I find that that's where people really have trouble with wrestling with this issue. But I want to end by looking forward. For you can't discuss God's wrath without understanding the third point, A, B, now C, that God's wrath was carried out and completed at the cross. Rutledge says, "If we think of Christian theology and ethics purely in terms of forgiveness, we will have neglected a central aspect of God's own character and will be in no position to understand the cross in its fullest dimension." If you don't understand the wrath of God, then you lose the full aspects of the cross and what it costs, and therefore I don't think you can love God the way he deserves to be loved. For all the wrath of God in the Old Testament, mostly aimed at the powerful, the wealthy, and those who oppress the poor, no one could have ever imagined or predicted that the solution for God would ultimately be that he himself would become oppressed, would become poor, would experience injustice himself, robbed of all dignity for no reason, and then taking on all the wrath of God, despite being the wronged, not the wrongdoer. And God took all the wrath that everyone ever deserved, including me, including you, and took it upon himself, the fullness of God, of the wrath of God, so that he, God himself, could remain just in punishing sin. I mean, how can you question God's character due to his descriptions of wrath in the Old Testament when he was willing to take it upon himself in the end? It's like, I mean, that solves the argument, right? And I get this argument a lot. I don't know about you, if you talk to other Christians about God being angry, what do you do with these passages of God being so angry at his people and smiting his people or all these things? But the end of the story is God eventually, for the most part, relents from what he actually says he's going to do to its fullest extent, as we've seen in Hosea, because he knows he's going to take it upon himself. The cross, of course, is where God's love and wrath fully meet and kiss in one beautiful, indescribable, scandalous act that displays simultaneously both the full anger and wrath of God over sin and injustice, but also his love poured out in such a way that he will take it upon himself. And he did so because, or so that, point 4D in our ABCs, so that God could delight in mercy, not wrath. See, God delights in mercy more than anything, not justice. Justice occurs because it has to. Not only is God's wrath not an act of impulse, but also he prefers to avoid, to relent from, and restrain his anger. The Bible describes him as long-suffering, meaning patient. He suffers long. He's reluctant to administer wrath while anxious to show mercy. Ezekiel 33:11 says that God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from their way and live. It's not like God enjoys being wrathful. As we already pointing out, God's love is permanent and his wrath is temporal. I mean, God's love will always triumph and overpower his judgments, and it's seen nowhere better than at the cross. Yes, people provoke God to anger, but as Psalm 30 verse 5 says, his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. And this concept is found throughout the Old Testament, perhaps nowhere more beautifully than in Hosea, where God's love repeatedly triumphs over his anger and his judgment. I mean, Habakkuk, the prophet, also understood this well when he said, God, in your wrath, remember mercy. Sort of almost pleading with God, realizing, God, I know that mercy triumphs over wrath. That's your permanent character, even though temporarily wrath has to be administered. I mean, even verse 9 from this week's text in Hosea 13, God says, you are destroyed, Israel. Not because God takes pleasure in destroying them. Why? Because you are against me, against your helper. God says, I want to help you, not harm you. That's his desire. A summary of chapter 13, really in general of Hosea, is that Israel is headed for death, both kind of spiritual death and physical death in so many ways. But God's ultimate desire still pops up, and we find it in verse 14, where he says, I will deliver this people from the power of the grave. I will redeem them from death. Where, O death, are your plagues? Where, O grave, is your destruction? It's a complex verse, hard to understand in its context, but likely an ultimate verse of hope, the triumph of God's mercy. And of course, it gets interpreted that way in one of the greatest chapters in all of the Bible, 1 Corinthians 15. This is quoted as a part of the resurrection text. So in the end, God's love wins. For the end result of God's wrath is that, the last point, that we could hope in the end that is to come. A different E word you could use could be the more biblical word, the eschaton, the word the Bible uses, the end that is to come, meaning where all of history is moving toward and pointing toward, the end, eschaton. And the Christian life is primarily, as I've said many times, it's primarily eschatological, meaning it's lived in light of what we know is going to happen in the future, that justice delayed is not justice denied, that God will make all things right. And that is good news. The final judgment for those on God's side is not to be feared. It's actually to be longed for. That's why the constant cry, the most repeated cry in the Psalms is, how long? How long, O Lord, will we have to watch innocent children in Syria be killed? How long, O Lord, will you put up with people feeding murders and other images live on Facebook for the world to see? How long, O Lord, will you continue to be merciful with this generation? I mean, God is way more patient than we are, but he will set all things right. There will be a day of reckoning, and if you're in tune with the heart of God, you long for that day. You watch the news and you long for someone to come and make things right. Because we see the sin, the destruction that it leads to. I mean, you think God is not furious about some of the things he sees going on in the world, but he will bring judgment in time. One day, all that is evil and distorts God's good creation and plans will be removed. And therefore, there will be no need for his anger or his wrath to exist anymore. There is hope beyond judgment because God, as Hosea said in chapter 11, is not a human. He's not a man. He is God. All will be well. As Revelation 21, 3 and 4 says, all things will be made right. The new creation will be a just one, and the need for wrath will be no more. It is not an eternal part of God's character or plan. It is a temporary need that exists. The band can come up there. I realize this is a little bit more of a thinking or a teaching message, but I think it's important to know and understand the God we serve and know that people really do get hung up on this issue, and they have trouble with these passages like Hosea 13. And we need to be reminded, of course, that often they are metaphorical. I don't think God's going to literally do these things. It's just a sign of his anger and his judgment in these passages. He's trying to express his displeasure and the reality of judgment because he sees the harm that his people are causing. And it's really his last resort, as we've seen, that God is so patient throughout Hosea. God's primary disposition is love. That never giving up, never stopping, always faithful, can't let go kind of love. So we need to trust in him, to trust in that love, that it is always good, even in his anger. And when we see injustice, we need to know and hope and remember that all things will be made right. So the wrath of God is an action, it's not an emotion. It's on behalf of and not upon the innocent. It's carried out and completed at the cross, thank God, so that God could then delight in mercy and not in wrath, and we could hope in the end that is to come. That's a lot of the gospel, really, in a sentence. So let's celebrate that by just singing of his great love that triumphs over wrath and that holds us and that won't let go, and thank him for how patient, how loving, and how kind he is with us and his forgiveness that comes through the cross and that he won't let go. And then Diane will close us with a benediction. Let's stand and proclaim and sing the character of God together.